doing things a little different with this week's podcast. Rather than one guest or two guests for an extended period of time on a particular topic, because we were at Gamma Expo, we took advantage of the opportunity to grab a whole bunch of different guests. So you're going to hear 10 to 12 minutes or so each with a couple of different people that we all flagged down during the expo. So, you know, hey, let's get right to it and check out who we managed to talk to while we were there. Record here. All right, cool.
No particular agenda.
Yeah, that's the point, man. Yeah. You know, a couple of war gamers in a bar and hit record. All right, exactly. So we're here with Drew Worley. You heard Cole on the podcast also. Now we had Drew joining us. And so we're still here at the expo. What's the coolest thing you've seen since you've been here?
Of course, our game. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding at all. No,
it can be.
We were lucky enough to booth next to Ren from Helsinki, who brought
the guys from
Finland. Yeah, exactly. So, or from Finland, and the fact I would peek over and see that he was showing off his a trick-taking game about the conflict between Catholics and Protestants in the 17th century
with the Hieronymus Bosch artwork.
Yeah, a lot of Bosch, and I'm like, I love that there's space for us here.
Yes,
that was great. But yeah, great. Yeah, so far, really interesting trade show for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the so you guys are sort of wearing multiple hats here. Cole specifically, with, you know, bouncing between. Are you guys just sort of only focused on Worley Geek here? Or are y'all leaning into helping later with any of the stuff they're doing?
I mean, there's so much cross pollination, beneficial chats between us. The knowledge share that we share between companies is, I mean, it creates discourse. It creates a dialogue so that we show our insecurities and our decision making, which I think strengthens our two companies. But also, I know that we're not the exception by far, and it's great to get that invalidation, especially at this show. Where I'm like, oh, people just ask questions, and they'll tell you numbers, and they'll tell you about how they came to whatever decision, and that's just like on full display at Gamma, and it's so refreshing. It's so refreshing. Yeah,
it's one of those things as a media dude, like, we got to be a little careful of, because we're going to overhear some of those things that, like, need to stay here. And, you know, like, we're not going to divulge anybody's numbers without them specifically saying, hey, please share these. But it is a little weird as a media guy to sometimes sort of hear some things out of the corner of your ears and they're like, hey, okay, I'm going to walk away.
Right. But between, like, publishers talking with other publishers doesn't always get to happen at other shows. And to have the space to hold that has been truly a treat. It's always so funny to also chat with folks coming from the retail space that never, like, that don't write comments, that aren't going to send in letters, and that have been talking up your game or whatever project you're working on. And I got to talk with the folks that Games by Berkeley, and I had no idea our games were getting over to UC Berkeley and are getting played on campus.
That's cool.
And it just was a delight to know that, oh, hey, here's a venue to get a chance to, like, meet folks in person and have them tell about their relationship with our games that I hadn't otherwise gotten that online.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I hadn't asked Cole this or really any other publisher. How many pitches if folks tried to throw at you guys?
Zero. I think folks finally know that my hands are full with our weirdo passion projects, and we're funny because I think I have called myself a publishing company for a while. I mean, we're a publisher, but we're more of a creator. We should be in the creator category because I've worked on Cole's games. But for the first time right now, we're actually trying to work on titles by other designers. But I'm not accepting pitches or anything like that right now, because that is like new territory. That is experiment. The last time it turned into Cole's first co-design project because of how full frontal, like, designer and developers we are. So we're gonna see if we can actually act like a normal publisher in the coming years. Who knows if I even like that work.
What is normal anymore?
I don't know. Right? It seems like everyone own the niche.
Yeah.
and then carve out the space for yourself. And then you can see how that looks between other people.
Besides that, what are the odds that you're ever going to work on something that would be considered normal?
Yeah, that's a good point. You don't think that a game about the history of the labor, the mine wars in West Virginia is a normal topic for a game?
I saw that one get pitched last year at Origins. So, yeah, I was like, that's kind of cool.
Yes,
so.
No, it's cool. And for that particular project, Kevin and I were talking about where should that game, Hellraisers, where would be a good fit for that game? And again, the talk between publishers about you just want these games to get made and for them to be made well. And to just know that there's a dialogue between publishers about like what would be best for the meat, for the canon.
And
it was nice to know that that's going to be our project. And if it's not a good fit, or if I just can't, I don't like the publishing work. I like developing and designing with Cole. That'll go right to Kevin.
Well, I think part of it too is that there's an acceptance and a recognition that different folks have different strengths. And I think it's the insecure person in the industry that doesn't want to share those things with other folks because they don't want to acknowledge or accept that that's not a good fit for them. Like, and we've talked about this a little bit with some of the media stuff right here. We don't generally do a lot of video stuff with the Dragoons. We stream stuff for like the ACDCs or the conferences, the Connections Online conference we do, but we don't normally put up a lot of live video. We're not like Mo's Game Table. Mo does a ton of those playthroughs and a lot of the edited stuff that he does, and he does a great job of it, but he spends half his life doing that. Or like Gary's show on Monday nights. I mean, you go back and watch a couple of the first shows, they were just sort of Gary flipping on the camera talking to it, whereas now it's more of
it's production.
It's a real production, and that's totally cool. Like, I'm very proud of Gary for all the effort and work that he's put in that. He's really made a great product out of it. But that's not a space we're in, and that's not a space I'm ever going to be in. So if somebody ever wants to do video stuff, I'm going to tell them to go call Gary or Mo. Or Mike over at My Own Worst Enemy. That's who I'm sending them to. Right. We're not going to try to do that. Right. But, you know, the flip side of it is we're like one of the two or three wargaming podcasts floating around out there. And so, you know, are you going to come see us? Are you going to go to History on the Table? Are you going to call Mark? You know, there's a handful of podcasts. But other than that, the general podcast, there's, you know, Stuart's got the Civil War specific one. And so it's cool when you see publishers do something similar. Like, you know, this is something that I think these guys would be better at. So go talk to them first and see.
And even having that with contributors, having that with like Peter, or like different voices with the Dragoons that are able to like bring so much variety to what can all sit under the umbrella of like, this is what we're it's a big canon. I can't do it all. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to find the best place to put things as much as possible. And you know, we've had a couple of these conversations, you know, hey, who would be a good war game company to try and work with to, you know, come back to Gamma Expo and do some stuff here. Folks are listening to audio so they can't see us in the room, but like Christopher from Catastrophe Games is across the room from us. You can yell, we can wave, they can't hear you wave. But we were talking about some Gamma Expo stuff for next year and talking about some other war game companies to approach to maybe come in here. And so, you know, some war game companies would be a good fit to be in here in the current state of the industry. Right. Some of them you may not want to be here or may not be a great fit for being here for the kinds of stuff that happens here. So.
And the fact that Cole and I, as like lifelong war gamers, the fact that we get to wave the flag about the interesting work, like I feel like we get to defend the category and genre and get young and new folks excited about that gaming because it's not that different from the sort of gaming experiences that are the trendiest tabletop role-playing thing. Is like, no, those are like the same foundational design blocks. There's a reason why war games have stayed around and loved the 6-hour epic experience, because you can also do that in a fantasy like setting on your role-playing game. But like we the fact that there's been interest enough and our projects have done well enough to bring us to booth a show like this allows us to have conversations where like, hey, I want to get eyes to the work of the Dragoons. to like get more eyes on adjacent projects that folks, again, haven't heard of, or it's like a little like out of fashion for them.
Yeah.
And I say, does it have to be?
We've talked about this a little bit before elsewhere on some of the podcasts, and I've made, quite frankly, some snarky comments on other people's content online here and there, but I mean, there's a lot of the game industry that the wargaming folks were way ahead of the curve on. Crowdfunding and Kickstarters make the industry go these days, and have been a key driver of publisher success for the last 8 or 10 or 12 years. Mm-hmm. P500 started for Wargamers in the 90s.
Right.
I mean, this isn't new.
The direct model has worked.
that pre-order, you know, P500, P300, whatever you want to call it, that system has been around, you know, literally since the 90s for the Wargamers. You know, the idea of linked campaign play has been around forever with consistent series of you know, interconnected scenarios for the Wargamers forever. The idea of the expandability of certain things goes all the way back to, you know, ASL and before, the original squad leader and before. So these are not new things for the Wargamers. The, you know, the common rule set across a series of games. Go grab the quad series games, you know, and that's, I mean, that's the system reference document. Yeah. So these are not new things for the game industry as a whole. It's just the rest of the game industry is not paying attention to Wargamers.
Right. Yeah. And so in any time that we get to, it's why I love our historical games, but also it's like doing the historical work of just preserving the industry knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's like the hobbyist knowledge is also somehow getting lost in it. So let's use our history, our historical game company, to also remember the institutional history of gaming so that doesn't get lost.
Yeah, totally. So for wargaming stuff, like I don't think you were at Gamma Expo last year out in Reno. So last year, not a lot of wargaming in the room. Mm-hmm. This year, a lot more wargaming in the room. Between Ad Astra and Collins Epic and Academy and Warlord and those guys, has there been any particularly cool wargaming stuff that you've seen floating around in the exhibit hall with the your fellow publishers and manufacturers and dealers? Or has it been more just sort of, I got a booth. I need to man the booth.
It's been a lot of booth. It's been over. I have not done the hall walk looking at like, let me be a patron. Oh, now that'll happen today. So I might have opinions. We'll have to record at the end of today.
You're gonna make Cole stay at the booth?
Yeah, please. You stay. It's my time to go get excited about what I see out there. I did promise Cole that at the end of, after we strike up the booth and head home, I said, we're doing a skirmish of Men and Iron in Normandy after this. We are doing it. So
yeah. So little brother getting uppity, going to make the big brother stay put and go wander.
Yeah.
As we start to wrap up this quick little conversation, and thank you for the time, especially because you guys got a booth to go man here shortly. Yeah. What has been your big takeaway from the expo this year? What's kind of the one thing that's really sticking with you for, you know, hey, this is what we need to act on, or this is what we need to make sure we continue to deal with, or here's some really meaningful something that happened while we were here.
The community building that happens at in-person events like this, of folks that carve out time of their schedule to come, and for the first time or for the fifth time or whatever it is, they just want the industry better, that they want more, like, newer projects, and then they're curious about the health and maintaining the health of the hobby is huge. And the most productive conversations I've had have been with first time or second time expo goers that are excited to volunteer their time with Gamma.
Yeah.
And that's been really refreshing to hear to hear people not just like feel like there's insurmountable things or pressures in the industry for me to prevent doing good work. So I think there's like some good optimism around floating around this show. And I'm like also quite excited to continue to double down on the work that happens at this show and at Origins.
Yeah.
And again, elevate some of the good stuff that's happening in the wargaming sphere.
No, it's cool. We may be a little insulated from it as the media guys, because as soon as the media folks walk around, everybody puts a smile on their face. But there doesn't seem to have been a whole lot of real pissiness or antagonism among anybody floating around out here. And that there's a lot of kumbaya vibes, which is fine, but it doesn't feel artificial.
No,
so
it doesn't.
That's nice.
I think people like today feels like the last day of summer camp in some ways, or the first. I can't quite tell. But that the vibe has been really good at this show, and I think Louisville's also, I think folks have really liked the venue and the new city too. So that's been great.
Yeah. So this is my first time back to Louisville since mm-hmm. I was at the Armor Officer Basic course in 94 down at Fort Knox. So it's been quite a while since I've been back here. The only thing that's a bit of a headache for us is that the media guys are at a hotel that's 3.5 blocks the opposite direction from where all the publishers are in the evening events. Yep. So we get to go the wrong way in the dark at 11 o'clock at night. It's a little sketchy out there. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, and cold.
New home, new venue.
Everybody's getting used to it.
Got to get used to it.
Totally understand. Well, listen, appreciate the time. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Let you get back to like why you're actually here instead of just committing with us. But no, we do appreciate you stopping by and good luck for the last day of the show. And I hope you do get to go be a tourist and that you you kick your brother's butt playing Minnevirn later.
It's my job.
Outstanding. Thanks. All right. Thanks, man. Hey, check it out. We're recording. All right. We are joined at this point by the coughing in the background, Jim Dietz. Dude, people are going to have headphones on listening to this.
Do I need to move to the other side of the computer so they can hear that in stereo?
Nah, we're probably okay. So in any event, another one of the guests that we've got here at Gamma Expo. Jim, you've done a bunch of Origins. You've done a bunch of Gamma Expo over the years. And we've tried to kind of explain to the audience a little bit kind of the difference between Gamma Expo, which is the business-focused trade show event, versus Origins, which is a very consumer-focused gameplay and sort of shopping mall kind of event. As you're looking at it from your side as kind of a vendor, as a businessman in the and I know that you've got a slightly different status as a nonprofit organization, right. But still, you're a business dude. You're selling games to people. How do you approach kind of the differences between the two events, between Gamma Expo versus Origins or a comparable commercial consumer-focused convention?
With Gamma, with the trade show here, this is pretty much all business. So that when I'm in the hall, I'll talk to retailers. If distributors are out wandering, I talk to them. Otherwise, I go look for them before or after the show's over, and that's it. Gamma this year has added their designer track, so there are designers here, which is a bit different. I wasn't here on Sunday to take advantage of that this year. Origins, it's about selling stuff to consumers and getting the word out differently. There is a lot of business that goes on with Gamma meetings at Origins as well. They're both good. They both serve different purposes.
Yeah.
I, having been to Origins a bazillion years, I very much prefer Origins. It's my favorite large convention in the U.S. because you're not rushed to sell stuff to people. With Origins, you get to sit there and talk to customers and get feedback and talk to designers in a relaxed way where it's not, thanks for your money, get the heck out of the way, let me talk to the next, or take the next person's money. You don't have to do that with Origins.
Yeah.
But I also have a soft spot for Origins now, running the foundation, because Gamma has permitted me to create an education track of seminars created specifically for teachers on how to use role-playing games and board games in the classroom, as well as design their own. Gamma has given me the budget to have some people come in and do seminars and workshops for teachers.
That's cool.
Which would include like Jay Little, who did 3 years of war for me. He did the Star Trek role-playing game. He did the Star Wars miniatures game.
Uh-huh.
Most people know he did a bunch of stuff with Warhammer back in the day. And then we've got Cole Worley is coming in on how using a game like Root with little fuzzy creatures and all that can be used to go into more sensitive topics like guerrilla warfare, asymmetric warfare, which is what Dragoon people care about.
Counterinsurgency in a petting zoo. I've said it plenty. And Cole laughs every time I bring it up. So I guess he's just being polite about the constant use of that joke. There's really no practical way in which anything like that teacher track would work at something like Gamma Expo because, one, it's during the school year, like the teachers are off teaching because that's what they do. But, two, like the teachers, there's no chance of the teachers ever attending Gamma Expo because there's nothing here for them. Yeah. And adding a teacher track wouldn't be enough to attract them to come here. So
no, I don't think
so. So it doesn't make sense here.
It would be the only people that could do it here in Louisville would be Kentucky and Ohio teachers.
Yeah.
And they'd have to...
Even that, they have to take a day off of school.
Yeah, either take the day off of school or the districts would have to declare like an in-service day and that they're permitted to go to this for the teacher education. And that ain't happening.
Yeah.
But that is part of it during the summer. Gamma, I'm so Cynthia and Becky and Julie with it have made it so that it is set up starting this summer that the teachers will be able to get professional credit for attending.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that they're going to get, if you're listening to this and you're a teacher, you've gone through your in-services where you're really on your phone, like checking ESPN or you're grading papers rather than doing anything worthwhile. But the reality is these seminars are going to be really good. And we've got stuff covering everything from kindergarten and first graders on up to college.
Yeah. Shifting gears here slightly, because you're here selling games to retailers and distributors and whatever. We know about Littoral Commander, because like we had that Wayne's World quality unboxing that we did last year at Gamma Expo out in Reno. When is the Baltic game? So as we are recording this, it's the first week of March. When are we actually going to start seeing the Baltic game show up on people's doorsteps?
Well, last year we got that Indo-Pacific came in while we were out in Reno. And it was gone quick. And we've got the reprint. The reprint came in 10 days ago, and we're already three-quarters of the way through the reprint.
Yeah, I think by the time people end up hearing this, like the reprints are all going to be shipped out. It's going to be done.
I've already had to set copies aside for Origins and conventions this summer. Baltic's maps are generally done. They are now being checked by the geographer. And if you're a Twitter person, you go find the foundation and Cascade Mac, there's been a discussion. Somebody from either Latvia or Ukraine asked this technical question on map resolution and distortion, and if hexes can handle that. And the map designer has his PhD in geography and cartography, and he started answering it.
So yes, the ultimate answer is yes.
Yeah.
and if you want more, follow the link in the podcast episode.
Oh, yeah. It's... But there are only going to be two maps in Baltic.
Okay.
North Baltic, South Baltic. The entire Baltic will be covered from Denmark on up to Bothnia.
Aren't they slightly bigger maps than what you had shipped in the Pacific game?
They're about, I'm going to guess they're going to be about 30-40% bigger than the Indo-Pacific
map. Yeah, so there's only two of them, but the individual sheets are bigger.
Yeah, the scale is not changing on anything.
Okay, this is a long way around not giving us a date of when this thing's going to show up.
Yeah, true. we're checking on the maps. The cards are done. What's coming up is we're getting ready in about a month. It'll be about a month before the rules go off to the editor.
Okay.
And once we've got that edited, there will be another check on... typos, and then we'll be good to go.
So it's not at the press where we're just waiting for the boat to come in yet?
No. My guess right now is going to be September, October.
Okay.
And it'll be the same size box. You know, we've put the art up on social media.
Yeah.
And right now I'm guessing it's going to come in at about the same 4.5-5 pounds of barbell weight.
Yeah.
The box is going to be packed.
Yeah. It sucks to carry on an airline, but other than that,
You can't say you didn't get your money's worth. There have been some nice comments on Indo-Pacific from, you know, just like, I can't believe they did this for this price.
Yeah.
And with the reprint, you know, we raised the price $15, but I would tell everybody listening, if you didn't already know, we worked that out with Sebastian, and all of that extra money goes to our scholarship fund.
Yeah, yeah.
All
right. So, Maneuver Warfare.
Maneuver Warfare is still on the website for pre-orders.
Yep.
I would like to fund it completely through that, but it'll go forward no matter what.
Okay.
We have enough money for it to go forward by taking out other money. The artist that's going to work on that is currently working on a Kickstarter campaign for us that will start on June 6th.
Okay.
Huh, I wonder what's on June 6th.
Yeah, yeah.
80th anniversary. She's doing a D-Day game for us called Order of the Day.
Yep.
And when she's done with that, she'll start working on the Maneuver Warfare layout and cover art and all that. Maneuver Warfare uses AI art. It's an intentional decision by Ian because of how the game is. And so we cleared that with artists that they understand what's going on.
Well, and Ian gave a talk to Goose about that, Georgetown University War Game Society. Ian gave a talk to Goose, and we've got that link to this episode also. So folks that are curious about sort of
Ian's approach to that and the philosophy behind it can go hit the link down below and go listen to Ian talk about it. Just play it on like 1.5x speed. You can still absorb it, but then it doesn't take 2.5 hours.
It's an interesting ethical question on that a lot of people care about as well. So it's worth listening just from the ethics and AI in the real world sense.
Yeah.
So, but that's what's up with Maneuver Warfare. I expect that probably by the end of 2025. At the latest, so next year.
Okay.
And that could speed up drastically depending on the artist's speed once she's done with order of the day.
Okay.
The other stuff that may be of interest, we've got another card-driven game coming up that will go to Kickstarter in August by a couple of gentlemen named Yoni and Ronan Goldstein. They're from Chicago, and it is the riots that took place during the Democratic National Convention of 68. And that'll be a game for 1 to 4 players called Chicago 68.
Yeah. So this is the part where most of the audience gets to mess with Jim a little bit. Dude, my parents hadn't met in 68.
Yeah, well, I was at least alive. So,
yeah.
So for most people, go Google it. It's going to come up a whole lot because the 2024 Democratic Convention is in Chicago, and it's on the exact same dates as the 68 convention, which is a weird symmetry.
Yeah, it'll be entertaining at least. All right, 1979 reprint.
Out and available.
It's out and available.
Have cool. it here. Couple of typos changed, couple of rules clarified, question and answers in there. Rules are now in color as well.
The stickers actually have glue on them.
The stickers are actually proper this time.
Okay.
Oh my God.
Just making sure.
Oh no, in the long run, after those stickers, I had the conversation with the factory that the next time this happens, I ain't giving them business no more.
Yeah.
So.
And then, was Free at Last going back to reprint?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I don't know what.
I know it had been. I remember you had mentioned it at some future date, and I didn't know if some future date had ever gotten specified.
We are not there yet. But I was able in January. One of the designers chose not to take the royalties if I would donate it to a specific cause. So we've been able to donate between those royalties and me topping it off a couple $1,000s to the John Scott Memorial Fund down in Louisiana.
Oh, that's cool.
Which helps underprivileged high school students go to college.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think we've hit all the big game stuff that folks would primarily be interested in. And talked a little bit about Gamma Expo versus Origins. In terms of Gamma Expo for you here, without giving away any trade secrets, what's a successful show for the Dietz Foundation at Gamma Expo look like?
Depends on the year. This year, the one frustration I have business-wise is Alliance Games handles sales to retailers in the United States for the foundation. None of the other distributors will handle it. They say the games don't sell. Now, the fact that we just talked about reprint of 1979, almost completely gone with the reprint of Littoral Commander, tells you that's boopkis.
Yeah.
And that's completely wrong. So success for me would be convincing a couple of these distributors to carry me so we get it into retail.
Okay.
What I would tell you and the people who listen to this, you know, over the years, a lot of people have been angry at GMT because GMT doesn't go through distribution really and cut that out. And GMT does a P500 program and sells directly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get into distribution and retail because I prefer to go that route. But I really do understand these past 4 or 5 years, the route GMT chose.
Yeah.
Because if I sell Littoral Commander to a distributor, I'm getting $34 for it. The rest of the money goes to other people. If I sell a copy of that direct, I get 85. So I'm getting 2.5 times the money, and clearly I'm still selling all the copies I want to sell.
Yeah.
Why would I turn that money down? It's because I like game stores being in business.
Yeah. Well, and part of that goes back to the difference between somebody buying it direct from you, in which case they've got to know you exist and know where to find you, versus somebody serendipitously stumbling across it on the shelf at their game store, or a game store being able to promote it because they know it exists.
Right.
And it's I mean, the difference in the money, you're paying for somebody else to do all the legwork for you of finding the store, convincing the store to carry it, and putting it in the store for you.
And I will defend distributors. I'm frustrated by it, but distributors are hit by something like 30 or 40 new SKUs, new products on a daily basis. So that's 200 new ones every week. you only have so many people on your sales and buying staff. How are you going? And retailers don't have time to look at 2,000 new products. They don't have room in their store. So I get why they want to be selective.
Yeah.
I just got to convince them that, guys,
you're the one to select.
I'm selling 3,000 of these direct. Yeah. How many more could I sell if you would carry them?
Yeah.
And then you would make some money on this.
Well, and at some point, the distributors just run out of brain cells, right, with that many things to keep up with. There's only so many people they can add to help wrangle
it.
They
do. So that would be the successful show here. Would it be nice to talk to a couple designers? Yeah, that would be great too. But for the most part, that's what I do at Origins.
Yeah.
Like talk to designers there, check out some prototypes. You know, people listening, I go to proto spiels too. And if you hear this and you're at a proto spiel and you see me, come up and say something. I'm happy to talk to
Jim. Jim needs friends. Just go say hi. Even if you don't have anything to sell him, just go say hi.
With some people, I'll even hand you a check, and the check will cash for being my friend.
Yeah.
Where's
ours? Okay, fair enough.
Some of them bounce too, but that's okay. But you know, I'm always happy to talk. You know how games can be used in a classroom, the educational value of the game itself, gaming in general, war gaming.
Yeah. So again, without giving away any trade secrets, like how much, if at all, it's something like a Gamma Expo, have you made inroads with connecting directly to any stores where it's not necessarily going through a distributor, but you're able to get yourself on store shelves by dealing directly with the store owner and sort of shooting some copies out there?
No more than about 3 retailers a year.
Okay. So it's not zero. It's just you don't need two hands.
It's minimal because most of the retailers who come here, they're going for the big people and they want to see the new Magic card. They want to see the new Whiz Bang party game and stuff like that. And I get that.
Yeah, they need to bring people in their doors too.
To be fair though, like a couple of the companies, like Labyrinth carried the stuff, but I did get to meet them in person at the last game, and they're supposed to be here this week.
Yeah.
Noble Knight already carried, knew who I was. They already pre-ordered stuff, so I didn't need to do that. So there are retailers and sources out there. I just need more.
Yeah, I wonder how many. So not, and again, as a media guy, like I don't know who the retailers are that are here. We're here mainly to talk to publishers and creators and those kinds of folks. So we don't really see who the retailers are unless we read all the individual badges and talk to folks. I am curious for the bigger war game stores out there. Complete Strategist is not here. Century Box is not here. Yeah. Gamers Armory is not here. Those bigger, well-known war game stores. Noble Knight's probably got some people floating around here because they've got people to spare to do that kind of stuff. I just wonder how many, if any, wargame-focused stores there are floating around out here
I have not
your primary target market.
In attending Gamma Trade Show for the past 3 years, I have seen none.
Yeah.
But now, rather than go, oh, Gamma Trade Show, I think there's some fault here. So that I think wargamers have not done a good job promoting the hobby or bringing new people in. I think it's become very isolated. And that's why we're doing the D-Day game, honestly.
Yeah.
Hey, play this with kids. Kids will like this. It's fun. My wife likes it. Great. Play it with your wife. Introduce new games to people because people love history.
Yeah.
And most of history is war, for better or worse. And if we do this, war games, again, will become mainstream. The styles become maybe a little different, like Race to the Rhine from Phalanx, or U-Boat, which is just cool looking and all that. So but that's how you get more people in. You get more people in, you'll be able to have more people making war games. Then there's a reason for Complete Strategist to come and visit and see what's coming up from these companies.
Yeah, and that's, without going into too much detail, because we're going to run out of time here on the podcast, but that's been an issue for the past 15 or 20 years, is that the argument that Gamma has ignored the war game companies, so therefore the war game companies stay away. The truth is, the war game companies staying away makes it easier for Gamma to continue to ignore them, because you're not clamoring for a seat at the table to get involved. And like, you know, as Jason Matthews will tell you, like Gamma was formed in part because guys like Avalon Hill and SPI and GDW couldn't get along, so they wanted a neutral arbiter in the middle of it all. We're not going to go into all that history here, but it would be nice to have a little better war game presence. I will say this though, I'm going to cut you off a little bit here because I intend to. But
who's the guest on the podcast?
But looking around the exhibit hall here, like we do have a greater war game presence this year than we did last year in Reno. Now again, this is my second Gamma Expo, right? So I don't have a huge base to comparison. But Academy Games is here this year that weren't here last year. Byron Collins is here with Collins Epic this year that wasn't here last year.
It's drivable so, non-flying distance.
This that does help.
A lot of East Coast people.
Yeah.
I think related to the war game thing, it's the issue, it's a coaching issue since I coached for a bazillion years. Like, oh, the kids don't respect me. The coaches, a lot of coaches out there expect the young person to give the respect first, and then the coach thinks that the player, you know, I'll give you respect after you've given it to me. I think, and nobody wants to take that first step. I think that's what's developed here between Gamma and War Game companies is, well, we're doing fine without you. Well, we're doing fine without you. Not really with the War Game companies, as War Gaming shrinks. Somebody has to be willing to take that first step. And yeah, ultimately, that needs to be War Gaming companies.
Yeah.
That's like, hey, we want to come back. We'll do this. And they need to put their trust that Gamma's going to try and do right with it. Because, like you've said, they're trying. And for people listening, I don't know if Brant's mentioned this anywhere else on this podcast since he hasn't edited it together yet. The Armchair Dragoon's space at Origins is expanding. It's
yeah, we've talked about it a bunch over multiple episodes. I'm sure longtime listeners are sick of hearing us talk about Origins.
But as somebody that's producing games, I know that like Littoral Commander is going to be there. 1979 is going to be there. It's a place for that to be played. And I know that you had to expand because people are like, hey, I can actually play these games here. So we've got that little kernel of a nexus to create a planet that eventually can become a black hole and suck in gamers from all over into Wargaming.
Well, this is going to be the 10th anniversary of the first of the Wargame HQs that we've done, bringing the Wargaming program back into Origins. It's not the 10th time we've done it. It's 10 years since we started because we lost that pandemic year in the middle. So it'll be the 9th time we've done it, but it's the 10th anniversary of it. Thanks, COVID. But yeah, we are going to be, and we'll be talking about that later in the season as we get closer to Origins. With more of that going on. But yeah, we're definitely doing that. So we're just about out of time for our reservation in the room, but you've got work to go do, so.
Yeah, and I got to go stand in line to buy some pop and candy bars.
Yeah, well, there's that too. Jim, thank you for stopping by. Folks, we got, you know, all kinds of other guests coming on the podcast here, so.
The 12th season of Mentions and Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Excuse for not being prepared, isn't it?
Exactly. No, I've been prepared, but it sounds so fake. It really does sound forced. And like, if you want the 60 minutes interview show, there's other people that do that. Mm-hmm. If you want to just hang out bullshit about war games, like that's us. So so we're here with James Buckley from Phalanx, and also has his own very active social accounts where you can interact with and chat with. And so over here from the UK. Do not adjust your set. The accent is intentional. It's not like my daughter's accent on the little Patreon thing where she's affecting a British accent because it sounds cool. I'm sure British people hear it and go, that is such a bad mismatch of, like, you know, multiple British accents, but she's proud of it. So
I've heard there's a whole generation of young school children in America saying funny words now because of the Peppa Pig influence. So, you know, it's...
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Wow. I imagine.
I'm so proud.
So... how many of these Gamma Expos have you done in the past? Is this your first one? You've done a couple of these, haven't you?
Phalanx has done a couple. This is my first
one. It's your first one here, though.
It's my first time here.
So in the day and a half that you've been noodling around the exhibit hall, what have you seen that really sort of caught your eye and you went, whoa, that looks kind of cool? I know you've been working your own booth. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah. I haven't had too much time to walk around. But I've actually been very interested in all the RPG side of things because I think the whole RPG world at the moment is really interesting and dynamic and creative and coming up with lots of interesting stuff, and the production quality is really good and it's got kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, and I'm really excited by the RPG world. So I've been going to Free League seminar, Modiphius seminar, obviously they do board games and miniatures games as well,
yeah,
just to sort of like see where they are, where they're at, and they're very inspiring in terms of that. So I guess that's what's been most exciting for me, is where all the focus on RPGs and where that's going.
You mentioned Free League. I'm not sure There's maybe a company or two out there that could. I think Free League has the overall best physical presentation and packaging and the sort of tangible thing in your hands. I think Free League right now is, for me, is the top of the heap of who's out there in the RPG space. I think their stuff just looks better and feels better than anybody else's.
I wouldn't disagree. Modiphius as well. I like them, and I personally like the Modiphius system a bit more, the 2D20 system, because it cleaves closer to Fate Core, which is like I really enjoy the players make up the narrative, whereas the Year Zero kind of engine of Free League is a bit more kind of like crunchy, here's a table, roll a dice, and this is what happened to your character.
Yes.
I'm more into like the theatric of the mind, which I think the Modiphius system does more. But Free League's presentation is stunning.
They're lovely. I think it's a fair characterization of the two systems, too, of kind of the difference between them. The one that I can't wait to get my hooks into from Modiphius is the reprint coming for the Iron Sworn Starforged game, because I was a big fan of the Iron Sworn RPG, that the fantasy one that the space one is based on, and it sold out like that. Okay. And they're bringing it back finally. The reprint is coming. People have already pre-ordered. I don't know if they're going to have them here. If they do, I might see if somebody would steal one for me. I'm very much looking forward to the Starforged game when that one finally comes back around.
I'm not familiar with that one.
The Iron Sworn game sort of took some of the concepts from the Powered by the Apocalypse type of system, and put it in a very gritty fantasy system. This fairly low magic, high danger, but it's a cinematic sort of thing where you actually have to play out the space between the encounters. There's actual tasks that have to happen between the encounters. But it's also very easy because of the way you resolve those tasks to do it in a GM-less way. Yeah. That you could almost play it co-op with like the three of you on one side against sort of the encounter. And it works really well. And so I'm curious to see how that transports into the space setting. Even though sci-fi stuff isn't usually my shtick, if it's good sci-fi, then Coriolis from Free League, is one. I don't generally like the ones that are tied to existing IPs because it feels like you gotta cut corners is the wrong term, but sort of fudge things to match the IP. Where in the movies you can get away with just making shit up and like nobody cares, but when you've got a game system with some set of rules that things have to conform to.
Yeah, I totally see that. I bounced off Alien, but I'm playing on Coriolis at the moment. I'm really enjoying it. And it's kind of fundamentally the same system. For some reason, the Alien one didn't work for me. And maybe it's because of the reason that you said. But I think what you talked about, where the kind of the GM-less side of things, that's really something I find very interesting at the moment, from like a design development perspective. Mm-hmm. And part of that's because of what we did with Purple Haze, which in some ways is like a GM-less RPG.
Yeah.
Look at it that way. And I think there's, I'm interested in that space, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's, people are more going towards solo games, and the whole thematic side of things, I think, is something that so far board games, which are called RPGs, or they're just actually dungeon crawlers. But there's more you can do there. So that for me personally, that's the most interesting thing I'm mechanically interested in at the moment, how you make that work.
Yeah. Before we torture you for some trade secrets out of Phalanx, in terms of the sort of co-op kind of thing, maybe an aisle or two over from you and a little ways back, the guys that do the Limitless Adventures, they've got a whole rack of these different things. They have figured out a way to do some co-op RPG games where it's five or six people around a table, and each of you sort of takes turns setting the scene and kind of the task before you, but then you guys play it out as a co-op group together. So somebody sort of sets everything up, does like all the set dressing, and then everyone collectively tries to tackle that encounter, and then sort of pass control to the next person who sets up the next scene, and then off you go through it. So that might be one worth.
Oh yeah, that's actually interesting. Yeah. That's probably something, if you've got the right group, that's going to work very, very well. But yeah, that sounds really interesting. Exactly. But that's why I'm so interested in the RPG space, because there's so much interesting stuff happening.
Yeah. So we're not going to get out of cattle prod or anything, but we are sort of curious on the Phalanx space. Mm. We did stop by the booth yesterday, took a bunch of pictures. A bunch of those went out today. So as we are recording this, it's today. Like, it's 10 days ago by the time people hear this. And And so not a lot. The things that you're putting on the table in the booth aren't the wargamey things because you're going for the mass appeal.
Yeah.
But you did have some cool wargamey stuff that you were showing us in the catalog.
Yeah.
Again, without giving away any trade secrets, what's the next cool thing showing up from you guys? And maybe what's the next thing that you're most looking forward to coming from Phalanx?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, what's on the table at the moment you can pick up in the stores are Iron Blood, Snow and Mud, and Total Domination. They're quite well publicized, so I won't go too much into them for your readers, because there's lots of Power to Play videos and stuff. And then obviously there's like successors, and we've just recently announced reprints of Hannibal and Hamilcar. And we also announced coming down the line there'll be a reprint of Hands in the Sea.
Okay.
That we're working on. So Phalanx does quite a lot of, we think we're quite good at doing these kind of pimping up an old game and reprinting it. And so in terms of what I'm excited about, there's two games coming down the track. One, Unhappy King Charles, which is an old GMT game by Charles Vasey. I'm a developer on that, and that's now basically gone to the printers. I've got to do one check on Monday morning, and then that will be sent off to the printers. So that's the same game, but Dom Hall Hegarty, who's a pretty famous creative, has done a beautiful artwork on it. We've added a solo system to it. We've redone all the user interface, redone the rule book. So that's something I'm very excited to see how people respond to that and how they like that. And then there's 1920, which is a game on the Soviet-Polish War of 1920.
Yep.
It was actually released in Poland, I don't know, let's say in the 90s, and but didn't get any wider exposure. But it's one of those kind of games which was maybe developed in a vacuum, and that's a good thing, because some of the concepts are like something I've not seen in a hex encounter war game, because it is very much a hex encounter war game, but it's got kind of like very unusual concepts around. Instead of your standard Zoc, you've got something called a line of friction, where it has similar effects to a Zoc, but it doesn't cover the whole hex. It covers the kind of the hex sides.
Yeah.
And some people have said, this is just a Zoc, but it's not, because you can move around it easier if you're more careful. And the designer is actually trying to capture the massive expanse that there was and the minimum number of troops that both Polish and Soviets had to cover that. So it takes the kind of the Zoc mechanic and does something different with it. It's quite interesting. And it also has like a concept of dynamic movement or reactive movement. So you can act on your opponent's turn. You can do a movement on your opponent's turn, and that creates very interesting dynamics between the players. And the other interesting thing about it is that there's basically three theatres, like the Northern and Southern Soviet theatres and the Polish theatre, although they're called something different. And you could actually play in basically all the scenarios, three players, because you could have two separate Soviet players, each controlling a different front, and there's mechanics of how you work through that. And that's a bit of a unicorn. If you can have like a hex encounter game that works good at two and three, that's a very good thing, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Often down in our war game club on a Monday night in London, we'll have one person joining at the last minute, and what do you do about that? And you can do that, and it works very well.
And there's only so many times you can go back to Maria.
Right? Yeah, exactly. yeah, exactly. Or Brotherhood and Unity, which is another fantastic game, but sometimes you've spent hours learning the rules of this game. I want to play this game.
Yes.
So very excited about that one. The art looks really nice as well. We're just finishing off doing blind play testing on the rulebook at the moment. It's got some unusual concepts, so we want to make sure that how we explain it works. So that's something else that's happening. And then, coming down the line, A Very Civil Whist by Fred Saval, which we're picking up some play testing on that at the moment, just to make sure we're happy with the balance.
Oh, cool.
So there are all some exciting things that are coming down the track for us.
Yeah. One last question for you, because I know you've got to get to work down on the exhibit hall floor. We just had Cole Worley in here a few minutes ago, and he said he's really hoping that you have a copy of Coalitions here to play with at game night some night. Are you going to make him happy, or did you not bring one and you're going to disappoint him?
Yes, I'm going to disappoint him. although he played at UKG last year, and he said, maybe he says this to everyone because he's such a charmer, but he said it was the best game he played at UKG last year. I'm sure that doesn't include his own games. But so he was very flattering about it. It's in production at the moment. I just saw a picture that got posted that all the miniatures are almost done. So I'm really excited about Coalitions, because I think of all our releases, that's going to be one that crosses the boundary between war gamers and non-war gamers in a way that's going to expand the hobby a little bit. So I'm excited about that. And also, I haven't even mentioned the game I'm most excited about, which is Purple Haze.
Yeah.
Which is now being printed.
Yeah.
So that's coming down the track.
That's
it's an epic, massive game. It's got like, I think it's about over 150 pages of different kind of mission stuff you can do. It's got you can level up your characters, you can have internal squabbles, there's so much stuff you can do with it. So I'm just interested to see how it's going to be received.
Yeah. For folks who don't know, Purple Haze is a very tactical level Vietnam game with a very heavy storytelling element to it, I guess, is the best way to sum it up.
Yeah, exactly. It's got story creation. So what you do, you actually create the story in some ways because you choose different options, kind of like choose your own adventure. But that can have branching storylines which can trigger in missions much later on in the campaign. Things can come back at you from what you did earlier on. But it's also got tactical combat, leveling up, these kind of things as well. So it's got, I think it's not something that I've seen done, certainly not in the kind of like historic conflict space.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested to see what... It's quite crunchy. That's going to be the challenge.
I think people will be really interested in seeing. I know that, like, again, what you have on the table at the booth isn't everything you got with you, because last night you guys had other stuff at game night than you did in the booth. And so I was curious if maybe you had a copy of Coalitions hiding somewhere you were going to get out of game night and... I guess not. Sorry, Cole. Sorry. Oh. Cool. We're going to let you go get to work. I appreciate you swinging by. And, a couple of weeks we'll have this out. And other folks will get to hear all about Gamma Expo after it's already done. But thanks for the time.
Thanks, Brent.
So we've got Cole Worley stopping by. This is the first time we've been in the same room.
It's
like,
true.
Been on podcasts a couple of times together and dragged you into Connections Online 1 year and finally in the same room. And so you mentioned this is your first Gamma Expo.
This is my first Gamma. I usually, this show has a reputation in the industry of being for the sales teams and the operations team and not for the creative side.
Yeah.
But it's growing and changing. They've got some design events and I see more of the creative teams kind of showing up. And so I just kind of wanted to snoop around and see what was up.
Yeah. Yeah. The impression I got, and again, like I've got one more of these than you, so not a lot. But the impression I got from talking to some people is they had a bunch of creatives showing up because they wanted to pitch stuff because this is where the business people are. And outside of trying to organize those pitch meetings, the creatives are like, well, what else do we do? And so they figured they'd throw some programming together for them.
Yeah.
And that's cool. Now can you do that for the media people that you invited?
Yeah, exactly. What I would love, one thing I would love to see in the future, and this is something I've talked to folks about, is we kind of need a good, I'll call it a professionalization conference for media, for people working sales, all the rest, and for the creative side of the company. And there are efforts to do that, and the most notable one is this thing called Tabletop Network, which is attached to BGGCon.
Okay.
The problem with Tabletop Network is it's 2 weeks before PAX Unplugged. So all of the people who actually work in the industry can't go because they're about to go to PAX Unplugged. Whereas this is actually the perfect time in the year because... the next show is Origins, and lots of runway before.
Yeah, the next big one. Yeah, it's interesting because we don't pretend to be a perfect media outlet. We're not by any stretch of the imagination, but we do have certain things that we try to do that others don't. Many of the folks, especially in the wargaming space, and you know this because you know a bunch of them are. A lot of the content folks in the wargaming space are one man shows, right? Gary's a one man show. Moe's a one man. Moe's Game Table. It's just Moe, not Moe and Friends. It's Moe's Game Table. My Own Worst Enemy, Big Board, like all these dudes, they're all one-man shows. And that's cool. Like they've got a passion for what they're doing and they're doing it. We've got a staff. Like we're a crew of, around a dozen or so doing stuff. And so that's kind of weird because people are like, oh yeah, Armchair Dragoons, that's Brent. Well, it's not just me. Like there's other people here too. But one of the things that's happened is like anybody can hang out a shingle and, hey, I'm here. I got content. And it's cool. Like I think that sort of punk attitude is great. But at a certain point, if you're going to be covering the industry at a certain level, like you said, some professionalization around this.
Yeah, and, just a little bit. And I think sometimes people want a little bit of leadership and a little bit of direction from the people who have been there for a long time.
Yeah.
And I've heard from folks who've been to some panels, and they're like, there's this funny thing that happens where people will just start asking questions in the panel, and it's obvious that like there needs to be some, more experienced person who would say, hey, here's a best practice.
Yeah.
I run into this all the time when it comes to something as in the weeds as game accreditation. Like, what's the difference between a designer and developer? And I'm like, well,
it would sure be nice if we had a guild or a trade organization that could delineate those tasks, but I'll just kind of tell you what I've done. And,
yeah.
I think that's true of the media folks too.
Yeah. And like, who gets a playtest credit?
Yeah.
Cause like last year, at Origins, so Kevin was from Fort Circle, had Halls Montezuma mm-hmm. on the table at Origins last year, and it hadn't gone to Kickstarter yet, but he was still showing it off, built some buzz for it. But because it hadn't yet gone to Kickstarter, he came back to us and said, I need the names of everybody that signed up for the events. I'm going to go ahead and credit them as playtesters in the book. Yeah. And I thought that was really cool of him, but like, you know, I don't know that that was ever an expectation of the players, certainly. I don't think any of them showed up because, hey, I get my name in the book. But, you know, who counts as a playtester? Like anybody that plays the game before it goes to press, or
it's fascinating. I mean, I'm a huge advocate of Amabel's work and all the stuff they published at Hollenspiel, mm-hmm. and I'm always surprised when I look in the back of their books and they don't have playtesters listed.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I know they're playtesting them, but they have different kinds of standards for like what gets different kinds of accreditation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that like when Drew and I are doing things, you know, for our playtester credits, those people usually play the game 3 or 4 times
yeah.
or more. Someone I happen to show it at a show, I'm like, no, I'm not going to give you a playtester credit for that. And that's just my own peculiarity. I'm deciding that on a whim. I'm being very arbitrary about it.
Well, and I think if you're going to get credit for playtesting something, like, provide me some feedback. So the fact you sat on a plate at a show and went, hey, that's really cool. When does it go on Kickstarter? Like, that's not any real actionable feedback, right. You know, whereas, hey, this was a neat mechanic, but maybe tweak this thing. You know, mm-hmm. now you can do something with that.
Right.
So you've been here like maybe 24 hours. Bumped in anything cool yet? What have you seen that's kind of neat?
I saw some new stuff from Academy, kind of in the veins of like, I don't think I can talk about it yet, but just simpler Hex Encounter and like really like
the Smolensk game.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, because we've already put the pictures out there. They're out there. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. just listening to how the system worked and, you know, thinking about, you know, I'll say like ways of hiding a CRT.
Mm-hmm.
That's a subject near and dear to my heart, and it was fun to kind of see that stuff in action. In the role playing space, I saw some exciting new stuff from Chaosm. I got to look at the new Pendragon stuff, which looks really neat.
Yeah,
and well done. But like today's my day for floor walking, so mostly I've just been running into other publishers and just chatting about, you know, everything from what we're doing, what we're thinking about, but crowdfunding and just interesting dev issues. You know, I'm here kind of showing two things. So I'm boothing with my brother. We've got a little Whirligig booth where we're showing Premier and John Company, because we hadn't planned on ever going into distribution with those historical games.
Okay.
Our whole model was direct sales, keep it like just the shortest line between us and our own audience.
Yeah.
But those games have done well enough that like there are stores that don't have access to us outside of distribution.
Oh, wow.
And so we've started entering kind of limited distribution where if a store wants to get a copy, there's a more traditional channel for them to get it. So this is a show we're able to connect to a lot of retailers who otherwise we have no connection to. And then on the leader side, we have the production copies of ARCs. And so we're showing the big space game there. And then in the evenings, playing Molly House, just kind of touching base with folks, showing them what we've been kind of up to.
Yeah, we oohed and aahed over ARCs at the Media First Look the other night.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, there was a bit of drooling going on.
Oh, good.
And then we connected with Drew over the Molly House table, kind of watched him show off Molly House to somebody else for a few minutes, and then we chatted about nothing related to Molly House for 20 minutes. But
Molly House is a really funny space because it is, the design is very close to being done.
Yeah.
Like I would guess that we are like a month of dev from being done. The graphics have not really had any kind of proper pass.
Yeah.
So it is the like scrappiest and ugliest looking prototype I think I've ever hauled around. I'm incredibly proud of the work that Joe and I did on it. But when people have asked to see it, I'm like, wait like 4 months. It's going to be so much prettier.
Give me a few.
we were playing at a bar in like low light and none of the colors have been properly embedded and it was just very difficult to play. And I'm like, the game's in great shape. Unfortunately, my prototype is falling apart.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's not to throw any shade on Molly House, that Drew and I were talking other stuff. I think I actually talked him into coming to Origins this year.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And like show up and just play war games with us all weekend.
Yeah.
So now the Smolensk thing from Academy, we shared a couple of the photos on socials yesterday, and the reactions have all been universal. Oh my God, I can't wait. This looks so cool. Or that is the ugliest map I have ever seen in my life. Like, it's one or the other. It's complete polarization.
Wargamers have such opinions about maps.
Oh, I know.
And it's funny because, I mean, really, does it have to do with just your attitude about the color green? Is it like part of the pro? You know, I run into, there are all these. I'm like, there's got to be this commonality.
Yeah. Well, so when I took a stab at being a publisher many, many moons ago, coming up on almost 20 years now. First of all, there's a good reason I'm not anymore. Like, I was bad at it. I didn't have a lot of fun with the business side of things. I enjoyed the creative side. Sucked at the business side. Happy to not do that anymore. But I did a lot of my own graphics work also. Just, mm-hmm. Sure. I am mechanically competent with the tools. Like, I've taught graphic design at the college level. I'm not creative enough to really do good-looking maps was part mm-hmm. of the challenge. And the original maps for some of my war games were just absolutely garish. It was sort of, hey, I learned a new Photoshop texture. Let me make sure it's in right. there. And it was way too much. And after the very first Origins, when I got a lot of feedback from folks about, hey, you know, this isn't really the best looking map, I started working on them. And I got to where they're both functional and not bad, not ugly. Right. I won't say they're attractive, but they're not scary anymore. So I can appreciate how hard it is to try to find that balance. It is a real tough thing to do. And so I always want to come back to, I like the map, I don't like the map, but that's my opinion. Somebody else is gonna happy to have a different one. I always appreciate the level of work it takes to do it.
Well, and I think it's important to make a distinction too between a map that works and a map that doesn't work. And sometimes the maps that look kind of like, I'll go on record of saying, like, I don't really like how the new Ogre looks.
Okay.
It isn't how I imagined a new version of Ogre would look. But it's extremely functional.
Yeah.
And the actual, like, map design, graphic design, I think I've never had any problems playing any of the I guess it's 6E Ogre. But sensibility-wise, my little pocket Ogre is, like, definitely still my favorite way to play that game.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think you have to divide those things out. Because I saw, like, the Solesque map, I think, seems very functional. Okay. And I think for someone who's coming to it new, it's going to look amazing.
Yeah.
But I could also see, like, look, it doesn't look like a Charlie Kibler map or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Rick Barber maps... Yeah. I would be happy to hang a Rick Barber map on the wall in the library and go, ooh, I don't like trying to play on them because to me there's too much background that it's tough for me to see the game necessary elements on top of a Rick Barber
100%,
map.
100%. Yeah.
Love Rick's artwork, but I have a hard time playing on them. Similarly, the Littoral Commander maps, Sebastian's game. Littoral Commander's a fun game. The maps are like scary stark in how contrasted they are all over the place, but that was an intentional design decision for people that might have like visual difficulties or color blindness or something. So I get why they did it. It's still sort of like, ooh, that's bright.
Yeah, it makes it just a little harder to like, you and I have talked about the Zucker games before, and I think one of the reasons why they're like my favorite maps is because they're so good at working with the colors of the counters.
Yeah.
And he has good notes where he talks about, like, look, you know, the French are blue not because of historic uniforms. They're blue because the sky is blue. And it's, like, an aspirational color. And it also, like, the Russians, I think, are brown. And he's like, yeah, because I wanted to, like, associate them with, like, mud and the earth and ground. And it's amazing because it almost sounds like... I don't know, like he's doing a tarot reading on these different armies. But actually, he's thinking about the way the color space is working on a metaphorical resonance and then sitting above the design of the map. Mm-hmm. And so it's always like, you know, I have a hard time judging a war game map because I kind of need to see it in action. I need to see what those counters look on the map.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it really changes the whole
thing. Oh, yeah, totally. Zucker's also got a 40 to 50 year head start on some people in thinking about these things because of how long he's been around doing this stuff. And it's, you know, if you ever meet Kevin Zucker or like Bruce Matthews was at our fall assembly back in October, and so I got to meet him face to face for the first time. You meet these guys that have been around in the wargaming space for a long time, and you're like, were you 12 when you started? Like, what the? Because they seem so young and so vibrant still, and they've been doing this for 40 and 50 years, and I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah.
it's crazy. I mean, they're really cool guys. So for y'all, for whether it was Root or Arcs or any of the other stuff, how much of what kind of creative input do you provide to the art team for, hey, I need it to look like this. Hey, I want it to give me this kind of vibe. Molly House, you mentioned we got to go do another pass for the... So what are you telling the artists for that, for the kind of vibe that you're after? Without giving away any trade secrets.
Well, I can give away some trade secrets. So I'll take them into sections, although you will see the commonalities. With Leader... So I work very closely with Kyle Farron, who's the artist, and he and I feel like we're an old married couple at this point. Like we get along. We actually spend a long time talking about color space before even any concept art is done.
Yeah.
We're thinking about what are the different like arenas of play, how are the different colors going to be sitting on each other, what's the general vibe. And then he and I work with a graphic designer at Leader, and we share tasks a lot. And every once in a while, something doesn't resonate, and I'll be like, hey, I actually want to take that and do the graphic design of it for a little bit. And so, you know, the ARCS map went through several different versions of really dramatic visual reimaginings.
Okay.
And at each time, like, I am, like, literally, like, making a bad sketch. I mean, like, Kyle, like, what about this? And then he's responding to it. And so there's a lot of back and forth. And some of this comes from, like, my own training is partially in graphic design. And so I end up, on Leader projects, I end up doing, like, a healthy third to half of the total graphic design I end up doing.
Yeah.
And then for Whirligig, I do almost all the graphic design.
Okay.
And so it is, these are intimately related projects. And, you know, one thing that Drew and I were just in the barroom downstairs, and we were talking about the board for Molly House, and I just took out paper and just started, like, drawing, like, okay, I think we need to, like, re-block it out in these ways. And we had a little bag of checkers, which I sometimes... When we have a kit, I'll usually have like a little bag of checkers or tokens in it.
Yep.
Because what I'll do is say like, okay, here's the board. And then these are where the pieces are going to be sitting on the board. How much information are we blocking? You know, how are we using the negative space? And then that is going to get communicated in a long email to our artist.
Okay.
And then there'll be a back and forth. And then sometimes we get, with John Company, we brought on another graphic designer to help a little bit just because there was too much work.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that's going to be necessary for Molly House, but we'll see. But the visual language of the game, for me at least, it starts evolving with the design of the game. And this is one of the biggest, I was just talking to somebody about rules usability.
Okay.
And because they were confused at why so many rule books are, like, not great.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I always hate saying that because I actually do think that rule books, if you were to look at the average rule book from this year and compared to an average rule book 20 years ago, they've definitely gotten better.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, a ton better. But the biggest reason why I think there is still, like, a little bit of a ceiling, a quality ceiling, is because publishing processes, as they professionalized, there are cleaner handoffs. So the designer says, I'm done, gives it to the developer. The developer says, I'm done, they give it to the editor.
Yep.
The editor gives it to the graphic designer gives it to the factory. Instead of saying, okay, now that we've got a new rulebook strategy, let's test it and see how it plays. Oh, but that means that we now need to redo all of the examples in a new graphical style. That means we need to, like, the graphic style now is pushing our spreads differently. So now we need the editor to, like, re-edit the words.
Yep.
And so it gets very messy. And my general attitude is, like, no, the design process is messy. Handoffs are bad. A product is done when it's done. And just, like, keep, like, cycling a project through. And so I will be re-editing, I mean, with John Company, I was reworking some of those spreads, like, right until the very end.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
We were learning things from testers, and I was saying, oh, like, if I actually change the order of these pages, it's gonna just improve the flow and the experience for a lot of players. Now, of course, that's also where errors get
introduced. Yeah.
So there's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you sort of drifted towards it a little bit, and so to not tie up too much time, this may be the last thing I ask you here, because... you'll probably give me a longer answer anyway. But so you mentioned you do a bunch of the graphic design kind of yourself with Whirligig. And so I'm curious, is that the control freak because your name's on the company? Is that because you guys have intentionally kept the company really small? Is that just you get a chance to do things that you enjoy doing and that's the outlet that you have for it? Or is it just because it's a small company, you're not going to spend the money to bring in somebody from the outside? Like, why are you so hands-on there?
When I first started working with Phil, and this also happened at Leader, so when I was doing things for Sierra Madre, I wanted my game to get published. And so I did the graphic design to be in the house style, or what I perceived to be the house style of Sierra Madre.
Okay.
And I think it made it very easy for Phil to sign the game. And when I was working on Root... I did a lot of the primary graphic design because the graphic designer that we had on staff was busy. It was a little too slow. He wasn't busy. It was just contract work.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, I'll just do some graphic design because I can iterate a little bit faster. And I had this general sense that the more of my own process that I can control and do, the faster and more agile the whole project's going to be. Because I don't need to say, I would like to do this thing. And then a graphic designer says, like, well, it's going to take 3 weeks. And I'm like, well, maybe it will, but if I do the work...
Yeah,
I mean, it's a little bit. I mean, there's a John Carpenter who writes his own music for his movies. someone asked him once, like, why do you do your own scores? And he says, well, I'm the best I can get for that price.
Yeah.
And which is how I feel about it. I'm not that good of a graphic designer, but I'm really good for being free.
Yes.
And so I find it's like less of a control issue and more like it's part of how I do my own design thinking. I'm thinking through it visually anyway. And so if I'm doing that, I might as well take a little bit of extra effort to kind of make the whole thing cohesive. And I do think when you get to the final product, there is a cohesiveness to
it. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, in the same way that like when you look at a Zucker game, or there's a few other war game designers who are like this, where you can really see, you can see their hand in every single part of the project. And like maybe it's because they want control over the whole thing, or maybe it's just because they're thinking about the whole project in one piece.
Yeah.
As opposed to the kind of designer who, you know, like finishes a design and then turns it over to another team.
Yeah, yeah. Kim Kanger is definitely that.
I completely agree.
It's funny because you mentioned like I'm the cheapest person that I can afford, and so that's why I've always done a lot of my own graphic stuff, and I'm seeing that now with a project that I'm working on with somebody else where the two of us are doing a bunch of the design work. Right now it's a lot of Google Sheets spreadsheets. It's really where we are right now, while we're just balancing the combat model and testing some conceptual things and sort of running a bunch of math to see if everything balances where we want it to be before we start doing too much else. But I started noodling around with some prototype maps and counters, just as one does. And what I've realized is that I have a hard time reining myself in. I don't know if this ever plagues you.
Yeah.
I have a hard time reining myself in because I start getting into the weeds on some of the graphic stuff. And it's like, all I need is a playable prototype. Like, I could do this with Post-it notes and, like, you know, a Sharpie, and I should be able to make this the playable prototype to like, move things around on my dining room table to figure out if the math works. Like, does the scale balance the way we want it to balance? But no, I'm, like, you know, changing angles by, like, 2 degrees on the graphics on the screen. I'm like, I got to stop myself from doing this.
Yeah,
do you ever have to rein yourself in?
Oh, yeah, you can fall. I mean, I will just tinker and tinker and tinker. And at a certain point, you have to stop, stand back, look at the whole thing and say, like, look, is this the best thing that I can do for this moment? And
you
kind of step away.
Yeah.
I've not had a problem, like, pulling out. I think what ends up happening is, at a certain stage, it's the precise inflection point you just described, which is you're working on the models and you start thinking, like, I wonder what a counter would look like.
Mm-hmm.
You design a counter and you're like, well, let's see that in situ. And then you like start, and suddenly you're laying out a whole map and it's, you know,
yeah,
it's big.
Yeah, and it's not just the playtest map, but like the green hex. Like, you're starting to put like forest artwork in it. Yeah, oh, that doesn't sit. Let me shrink the scale on the background art a little bit. And you're like, why am I doing this?
I feel like the longer I've been working, the better I am at like holding that part off and being like, it's going to look better. But I more eagerly jump into the general like wire framing and blocking out where I love the transition from the Google Sheets and Google Docs to like the first pass of the graphics, where usually it's monochromatic because I don't want to waste all my color ink.
Yeah.
But there is visual hierarchy and all the kind of like core graphic stuff is starting to fire up. That gets me really excited.
Yeah.
And then I have to hold off because otherwise I'm gonna start throwing paper textures on things. That's never good.
No, totally get it. As we wrap this up, quick chat with Cole Worley here at Gamma Expo. Is there something over the next day and a half that is on your, oh my God, I got to do that list?
I want to go hang out with the Phalanx guys.
Okay.
And I want to see if they have Coalitions and if they'll let me play it. Because I played Coalitions at UKGE last June, and it was like almost done, and I had such a good time. It's fabulous.
I didn't see it on the table yesterday. They've got a couple of the more wider appealing things, like Rocketman is on the table. Huang is on the table. But last night they did have Triumph out at game night. Might have Coalitions, but it might be sort of under the table and they're going to pull it out at game night.
It is like, I think it's going to be shipping this year, and it is one of my like higher tier, like I'm very excited about the release because I was just really impressed with it.
Yeah. The problem we have talking to Phalanx and James Buckley and I joked about this a little bit on the floor yesterday. The problem we have dealing with Phalanx is, they do stuff that sort of trends more mainstream versus just the niche war game space that we live in. And I want to see the niche war game stuff, but that's not what they bring to this show.
Right. Because I want to see, like, show me the newest Unhappy King Charles.
Yes. Or the 1920 Russian Polish air game that they're working on, yes. you know, with the biplanes and the frontline fight and all that stuff. Like, that's what I want to see. Right, but, right. you know, no, they got Rocketman on the table. And Rocketman looks cool on the table, and it's going to attract the exact audience they want to pass by and order cases of them, and that's cool. But that doesn't do what I want.
Well, and there's
so I'm being selfish here.
Right, and there's a funny thing about this show where the things I'm looking forward to are really conversations with staff about upcoming things. Because if you go to a Gen Con, people are happy to show prototypes. This is a show for retailers, fundamentally.
Yes.
And so you're only showing stuff that you have in stock or that you will have in stock.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Stuff they can actually order.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It goes back to our philosophy for Tuesday Newsday. Like, we put stuff... We'll talk about other things as they get announced or whatever, but like Zilla Blitz each month puts out a video of the top 20 war games that I'm looking forward to. Some of these don't have ship dates. Some of these haven't gone to press yet. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Like, you want to build some buzz for those things, but for us, for Tuesday Newsday, until I can click a button and do something, I don't want it in Tuesday Newsday. So when it goes on P500, when it goes on Kickstarter, when I can actually, when it's in stocks, so like Molly House, I'm not going to talk about until sure. we had it on the Kickstarter, but you know, until it actually goes to retail, it's not going to show up in there again. Right.
No, I will tell you.
So that's what's going on the floor here are those guys.
The thing I am most excited about is I'm spending a little bit of time with my dear brother, and we are going to play some Men of Iron tomorrow night.
Probably. Oh, wow.
And I'm like, that's actually what I'm looking for.
Totally got to get a picture of that, because the guys over on the Homo Ludens Discord server will go absolutely gaga for that.
Okay, good. Yeah, it sounds like there's a little bit of division. I don't know if Fred is super into Men of Iron.
I don't know if he is, but Stuart and Russ and those guys are absolutely going to be thrilled.
It's a fine game.
So cool. Well, listen, thank you for the time here. I don't want to tie you up too much, especially because the exhibit hall is going to open in a few minutes.
Yep.
But I appreciate it. I have no idea how I'm editing this together to know who's coming up next, but Kevin's in here at some point, and Jim was already in here, and I don't know what order they're all going to be in. So thanks for swinging by. So adding to our running tally of podcast guests here, Jason Matthews is here. Most of you guys will know him as designer behind Twilight Struggle. Well, part one of the designers behind Twilight Struggle. But also, Jason is one of the Gamma board members. And near as I can tell, you lost a bet. But but Jason is on the Gamma board as one of the publisher reps. And so he's going to have kind of a slightly different viewpoint of what's going on here at Gamma Expo compared to most other folks. We've talked some about kind of the business focus of Expo versus the consumer focus of something like Origins. But at the board level, what is it you guys want and see out of the Expo here compared to like the publishers or the stores or whoever walking around?
So I think there are a couple of takeaways from this Expo as opposed to the last several in Reno. And one is that the desire and necessity for professional development all across the Gamma membership lists, the desire is and need is very high. All of the seminars that have been hosted here at Expo have been extraordinarily well attended, and the only thing I have heard as a board member is that we want more. And part of that is that so many, even in my category of publishers, we have so many independent publishers who are members of Gamma these days, and they tend to be the same kind of two or three people operations. They're smaller than the retailers.
Yeah.
And so the retailers have had for many years a very organized professional development program, both at Expo and at Origins, and a very structured system to their membership category. And I think the rest of the elements of Origins are starting to be like, hey, we need that stuff too. We don't know how to do taxes either. We also want to learn how to write a contract. So there'll be more of that for sure.
Yeah.
There's a taste and desire for it. The other thing that we found at this expo is we've started to do more cross-pollination with different kind of seminars where we're having publishers and retailers meet and trying to break down some of the silos within the industry so that people are actually talking to one another. And that is how business develops, obviously. And since Gamma exists to convene all elements of the industry together, where we have done that successfully at this show, people are raving about it. So we need to do more of that as well.
That's cool. That's cool. The can we not do them at 8:30 in the morning?
Oh my God. I hate it as well. And it's hard to find a Starbucks in Louisville, so that's another problem.
Yeah, we're referencing the 8:30 media committee meeting we had this morning that for whatever reason, maybe that was the only time the room was available. I'm not really sure. But yeah, the 8:30 in the morning is tough to drag yourself to when you were out playing games past 11 o'clock the night before.
The reason it was so early is we had to switch it from Tuesday to Thursday, and then it was the only
reason. Yes. Yeah, well, and look, stuff like that happens. Yeah. I get it. It's interesting that the retailers were the ones with a lot of the professional development stuff. And so folks that haven't seen the video already, you can go back to the page and go take a look. I did a flip through the site book. Up here when the keynote welcome speech was going on, that they seated the room for, I don't know, about 900 people, and there's 2,400 folks here, and so there was nowhere to be in that room to watch the keynote. So I came up here to the media room, and I just got out the site book and kind of flipped through it and just turned the camera and let it run. And that way folks got a chance to sort of see some of the differences between this and like an Origins or a Gen Con. Like the Tax Wizard guy is a great example. Like, you would never see a booth for the Tax Wizards at Origins.
Right.
It's just not going to happen. But here, that's like a valuable service that they're going to provide to some game store somewhere, or some, you know, those two-man publishing companies,
right?
And so that was an example of the difference. Showed some of the event grid in there, and so those professional the seminars help. I accidentally became a game publisher, which I think is an awesome title. It's like one of the best titles in there. That was one of the ones in there that sort of jumps to mind as you're talking about some of those professional seminars. So I think it's, first of all, I think it's cool that they've got them. Second of all, creative names are entertaining.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it is, you know, it's exciting to watch the hobby grow from sort of handshake hobbyist,
yeah,
nothing is professional, into something that's starting to resemble a real industry where people can go and earn a living and,
yeah,
and be taken seriously.
Something semi-professional.
Yeah.
Other than some of those seminars and the feedback that you got as a board member around those seminars, thinking mainly of like the exhibit hall or something, what's something out there that you saw that was really cool that you sort of stumbled across or kind of knew might be here, but you went there and you went, whoa, that's kind of neat.
Okay, so we're all nerds here, even those of us who are, you know.
Look, if you're listening to this podcast, you're a bit of a game nerd, yeah. Right? There's
so there's a Polish company called Archon. They do a lot of these kind of big box. They did Heroes of Might and Magic. They're doing the He-Man game.
Yep.
These like big box Kickstarter.
You can't call them Ameritrash because it's a Polish company, yes, right?
Exactly. That's it. But that's the real difference. And they have invented a machine that will pre-paint terrain and figures on the sprue. Wow. So
I saw somebody hold, it might have been you that was holding it at the booth the other day.
Yeah.
That it looked really cool, but I didn't know who it was doing that.
Yeah. So, and the crazy part is, like, the increase cost for, mm-hmm, these pre-painted sprues, it's going to be like 20%. So,
wow.
It's like if you're an old man like I am and you can barely hold your palsy shaking hands from gluing and painting, it'll be a godsend. And I'm excited to see what happens with that part of the industry.
So there'll be no more excuse for showing up for Minnie's night with an unpainted
arm. Now you should just be thrown the hell out.
Yeah. No, that sounds really... I saw... I think it was you that had it at the, yeah, booth the other day when we were chatting. And it's, wow, that looks really cool. I didn't realize where it was. So
yeah.
Now I'm going to have to go finding it.
Why? Are they broken?
Anybody here that you met that you hadn't met before, you're like, whoa, that's really cool. Glad to meet you. Nice to see you.
No,
I mean, you being on the board, you're going to like meet everybody at some point.
I understand Steve Jackson is here and I would love to meet him because I've never had the opportunity or,
yeah,
occasion. But there are still 2,000 people here. It's not as big as like Origins or a large con, but it's big enough and enough going on that there are friends of mine here who I still haven't bumped into.
Yeah. again, we've talked about this not necessarily being a consumer focused event, but if I'm a consumer out there thinking about, okay, Gamma Expo's happening, there's a lot of business stuff going on. As a consumer, what, if anything, am I going to see when once it all trickles down and, you know, gets filtered through the different people here who are doing stuff? Is this different things in my stores? Are the stores going to start laying things out differently? Are the publishers going to start pushing different stuff to me? Newer publishers? Like, what am I going to see as a consumer?
I mean, I think it's important for the kinds of conversations that are occurring at this convention to happen, because it's an opportunity for retailers to give feedback to publishers about what they're moving, what their customers are interested in, what they can sell in their stores. Mm-hmm. This has some issue with, there's a perennial fight and debate between publishers and retailers about the size and shape of packaging, because it takes so much of their floor space. So there's really no other place for those conversations to happen on a mass scale than this convention. It's for the whole industry worldwide. So that, and of course, publishers are here mostly to market to retailers and to tell them about what their catalog all the way from here to Christmas is going to look like.
Yep.
The industry has gotten to the point where by March of this year, everybody's printing plans are already full, so you can kind of anticipate what's going to be happening in the summer, and then again what's going to happen in Christmas. But this year,
well, what's getting printed, not necessarily what's getting stuck on a boat somewhere.
Right. They can't tell you when you will be disappointed yet, but it will happen.
Yes.
This year, though, for the first time, there was also an opportunity for publishers and game designers to network here. That has always happened somewhat at Origins,
yep. but
for the first time, there was a very organized way for that interaction to happen on a business-to-business level here. And so that's another positive, exciting development, and you know, another avenue for new designers to be discovered and
That's cool. Two more quick questions. Have you had a chance to play anything at the game nights, and if so, was there anything that really caught your eye or that you really
enjoyed? I unfortunately have not been able to attend game nights because I have been booked in the evenings.
Actual
I think
business
we still
stuff.
Have yeah I think we still have one this evening. I'm clear tonight, so I'm gonna go if
well, there,
yeah
try and get have some fun. All right. And now for the fun one, and look, if this is going to turn into like a entire episode length answer, we can do this at another time. But how do we get the Wargamers to show up back in here?
Oh God, that is a, I mean,
I know I'm asking you an essay length question with multiple choice answer time, but still,
I mean, for one thing, there's us, right? So there's this word of mouth, there's the pushing and we are both doing it. And we have some additional allies. And it's only going to be an incremental thing, right? We'll aim to add one or two a year. But the truth of the matter is, both for Expo and for Origins, these are business opportunities that are affordable. We have this additional problem in our sector of the hobby where, you know, Compass and GMT and some of, and Worthington even, they're not carried by a lot of retailers. There are a lot of game stores now, over 700 in the United States and Canada. And that's a lot of missed potential sales because those guys do not have a lot of direct relationships with retailers.
Yeah.
And
they
could develop those relationships here.
Yeah.
And so I think it's missed opportunity. And there's a little bit of, I mean, I don't want to be like, get over it, guys. But there's a little bit of, I know people's feelings were hurt in the 1980s. But that was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's time for people to kind of get over some of that.
Yeah, you're not making me feel any better with the whole 50 years being part of this. Right? I mean, that just...
I
that hurts.
I know we're upset that we had been replaced by the role players at Origins a long time ago, but, you know, we're so far... You have to be old to even remember that history
yes.
anymore.
Yeah, well... And I will say, so last year when I was at the Expo, it was the first time I'd ever been. Yeah. No idea what I was getting myself into, which is why I hung out with you and Kevin a bunch, because, I didn't know anybody else. And aside from, oohing and ahhing over a bunch of the dice stuff, there were some role-playing things that I was interested in. But the only other real war game stuff that I saw out there, there was Shores of Tripoli that Kevin had with him. Dietz Foundation had just gotten Littoral Commander, the first printing in off the boat, because we did the unboxing there. And then the guys over at Ares Games, where they were carrying the stuff from Nuts. And, that was it. Yeah. The only other wargaming-related stuff was, the Warhammer stuff.
Right.
And this year, Warlord's down there with all the bolt-action stuff and all the rest of their minis wargaming stuff. Collins Epic is here with... He's showing off Polyversal, but he's still got the Spearpoint 43 stuff to talk about. There are other folks here. The Ad Astra guys are back, so sci-fi space combat stuff. We've got some wargame folks here doing stuff. I mean, the Ares guys are still here. Dietz is still here. Fort Circle's still here. So, I mean, we've got other folks here. The Renegade guys have the Axis Ally stuff. That stuff moves. That is a wargame that people are interested in. We could build off of stuff like that. And so, I mean, there are wargame companies here that seem to be successful this week.
I totally agree. And it's... ultimately important, though, for our standard bearers for the hobby to be here as well. They are how our sector of the hobby is known. They're the ones with the gravitas. They're the ones with the catalogs. And they should be here.
Yeah.
So I've been banging on Gene for the better part of a year and a half about it. And I'll continue to do so until he relents.
Cool. Well, Jason, thank you for the time. Appreciate it. We're pushing up against lunch as we're recording this, so we're all going to go, take a break and nosh on something. But we do thank you for taking the time and for Gamma, hosting media for folks like us to, show up and do stuff. So that's pretty cool.
It's great. And I'm glad you're here. Thanks, Brent.
Appreciate it.
And there you have it. Our visits at Gamma Expo. Yes, plural, because we had... both of the Worley brothers, plus Jim Dietz and Jason Matthews and James Buckley, all stopped by and chat with us while we were at Gamma Expo. This is a little longer episode than we've been doing this season, but we hope you enjoyed sort of the pastiche of different visitors that we had while we were at the expo. Would have loved to have had a couple more, but that might have made the entire podcast episode a little too long, and maybe we'd had to split into more than one, and maybe that's what we do in the future. Anyhow, we hope you enjoyed this look at Gamma Expo and the other coverage that we had from the show. And look, we'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioning Dispatches.